You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF. I'm Scott Lamar. Most Americans probably believe we have learned everything there is to know about World War II since it ended more than 76 years ago. But the public release 2 weeks ago of what is known as The American Soldier in World War II has provided hundreds of thousands of viewpoints from American troops on their combat experiences, race, and mental and physical health. During the war, the U.S. Army administered surveys to more than 500,000 American troops. The results were closely guarded until now. 65,000 pages of uncensored opinions have been released. Some of the unvarnished opinions have raised eyebrows as soldiers complained about or criticized the military, the press, and racial, ethnic, and religious groups. Joining us is Muhlenberg College Professor of Media and Communications, Jefferson Pooley. Jeff Pooley is on the project's advisory board and is a social science professor or studier, I should say, at studies of social sciences at Muhlenberg. Dr. Pooley, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Scott. I'm happy to be here.
So more than 75 years for this information to be released. What took so long? Why were the results of these surveys not made public?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a kind of serendipitous discovery from the chief researcher on this project, a historian at Virginia Tech, whose name is Ed Gitra, who was doing some research at the National Archives and came across what were not classified, but were essentially buried, these microfilmed versions of, like you say, 65,000 pages of handwritten responses from enlisted men in the Army and the Air Corps. And it was possible to go there, I suppose, if you were a researcher, but no one knew about them. And he hatched this idea back in 2009 to get these not just digitized, but also transcribed, because these were all handwritten. And so this historian started teaching the handwritten responses in his classes and then applied to a National Endowment of Humanities grant, which made possible this massive effort, which I think over 7,000 different citizen transcribers, people who just volunteered, who were into World War II history, took part in transcribathons, as they called them, and produced four versions of every single page of these manuscripts. And the best one was chosen, and they are now available on this NEH-funded website where you can, yes, read through messages that are in some cases prejudiced, and some of them are hopeful and heroic, some less so. It's a fascinating trove that school children, citizens, researchers alike will, I think, use.
And by the way, we have a link to it on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk, The American Soldier in World War II. What I would compare this to, Professor, is an exit interview for the soldiers. So what were the surveys designed to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, when the U.S. was not yet in the war, this is before Pearl Harbor, but it looked like, you know, the Germans were advancing in Europe and France had fallen. The U.S. Army created a morale branch because they had a new conscription army, that is to say people were being drafted, and they were concerned about these new citizen soldiers' morale. And so in the next year, 1941, they established what they called a research branch, and they brought in some sociologists and psychologists. And the idea was to ask enlisted men, basically getting them in a mess hall or a place like that, and ask them a series of questions with no officers around. And most of these questions were, of a multiple choice kind, but there were these open-ended ones as well. And so they would ask them about everything. I mean, things like, what do you think of the laundry? Or what about the USO? To questions that were much more about the kind of direction of the war. Like, do you usually feel that what you're doing in the Army is worthwhile? That sort of thing. Or do you feel proud of your company or your squadron? And they would compile these answers, especially the ones that could be counted, put them into reports and send them up the chain of command. And this was during the war, right? So you're right about it being an exit interview, but it was sort of, you know, as if you were being interviewed along the way. And these would be sent up, and the idea was that they would then inform policy changes. And they did in some cases. But they were meant to be like a snapshot of the opinions of the everyday infantryman.
You study social science and the history of social science. What struck you about what these soldiers had to say?
Well, I'll tell you that, you know, the fact of these surveys being sent out had been known for a while. The psychologists and social psychologists I mentioned, there are about 120 of them at the height of the effort. After the war, thanks to a foundation, the Carnegie Corporation's funding, they got together and produced four volumes. They're kind of, they're well known as the American Soldier Studies. They were published in 1949. And actually, thanks to the effort of this initiative, they're all now open access, which is to say that they're totally free for anyone to download in their original PDF. And the books themselves had this enormous influence on the trajectory of social science in this country. They were kind of like a exemplar of the new team-based quantitative social science that took off after the war. So they had that kind of importance. They also, you know, informed this new area of sociology called military sociology. But they were also important in the evolution of the military itself and the idea of like taking the temperature of various members of the armed forces kept going all throughout the, and indeed to this day is a kind of legacy of these surveys. And I'll just add that they also did experiments, not just surveys. They also got the enlisted men to fill out a form beforehand asking about their kind of commitment to the war, to the Allied cause. And they then showed them one of these Frank Capra made Why We Fight Wars. Some of your listeners will have heard of them. There were six movies. They were kind of documentaries, but meant to inspire a fighting spirit in the army infantrymen. And they would ask them after they watched the movie whether their opinions had changed, basically. And so they were interested in that kind of thing, too. Like, how good is our propaganda?
And from what I saw, it was kind of split as the results. It wasn't like an overwhelming majority who said, oh, yeah, I definitely am psyched now, or no, it really didn't have an impact. Earlier this week, Washington Post reported on this. The headline said, "The Greatest Generation Survey on Race, Sex, and Combat During World War II Runs Counter to Its Wholesome Image." Does it?
It's a good question. You know, a lot of the responses, which, you know, you're welcome to browse yourself. There's a great search engine. A lot of the responses do record outright racism, endorsements of white supremacy, explicit anti-Semitism, a lot of sexism too. And these soldiers were kind of guaranteed that their commissioning officers wouldn't see any of this. So they're sort of their unvarnished opinions. Of course, it would be a mistake though to read those comments and take them to be the typical. You know, far more common were comments that were talking about, you know, the officers looking down on them or complaints about being posted in the South when they're from the North, that sort of thing. But yes, it certainly does provide a different picture of the Greatest Generation, if you will. And in that respect, yeah, I mean, you should be a little bit warned when you go and read these that they're kind of uncensored and you know, contain offensive materials. I'm happy to read one or two of them if you like.
Yeah, go. I was going to do the same thing, but go ahead, pick one out if you want to.
Sure. I mean, there were lots of comments I would say about officers because these were, you know, the grunts, the rank and file who were answering these or writing these handwritten responses. So here's one. I wish our superiors would read the Bible more. It would do them good. Or take another one. I think my company would do a whole lot better if we had a good company commander. This bastard don't give us what is coming to us. And other companies are on furloughs as such. But he wants to keep his company up to full strength for no reason at all. Please see if something can be done about it. Thank you. And so on. I mean, even responses that were about the civilian population. Here's one soldier writing, only that if the civilian population would treat soldiers like men rather than like dogs at times, everything would be okay.
There seem to be a lot of complaints, if you will, about the length of time that these soldiers, and I mean, today, when we compare it to the deployments to the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Iraq over the past 20 years, there have been people who have been deployed multiple times, but not usually for more than a year or so. When you look back at World War II, and there were soldiers who were deployed for three and a half years overseas. Well, here's one who complained, if the Italian front is important enough to continue, why in the hell can't there be a few more divisions sent here instead of replacements? I've been through the whole Italian campaign. As yet, I haven't been hurt. But, however, day by day, I see my buddies being wounded or killed. My luck cannot hold out forever. You can never wipe out a division, but all of her old men can. Now, that's sad on a couple different levels. First of all, you know, it sounds like a soldier who is wondering when his day will come. And also complaining about being on the front for so long. Is that typical of a lot of what the soldiers had to say?
It's certainly one of the major strands. And you're right. I mean, the reason the whole operation to survey the soldiers got set up in the first place was this concern about morale. And one big difference from our volunteer army, of course, is that most of the infantrymen were conscripts. They were drafted. And so they were, you know, in most cases, if you judge by the answers they gave, very much in support of the war effort and claimed that they cared about the Allied cause, but they weren't there by choice. And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of the complaints have that character. There also are just the stuff of everyday camp life, you know, that gets asked about. So one of these is complaining about the barracks, right? They could here's a soldier saying they could stand a lot of improvements. They should have larger latrines. The food should be varieties more than it is. I'm quoting again. They should have more men for officers instead of what they call 90-day wonders, and on and on. So you see these kinds of everyday gripings about the daily life on the camp, whether that's in the U.S. or in overseas theaters.
Yeah, I saw one guy who was complaining about the uniforms being too baggy, that they weren't comfortable. So it is everyday kind of complaints. But I will say that one of the things that did stick out was race in particular. A great majority of the white soldiers thought units should be segregated between black and whites. In other words, they didn't want blacks in their units. And this was broken down even between soldiers who were from the North and the South. 75% of those from the North said that the unit should be segregated. 85% of those from the South. I want to read another entry from a soldier. It says, the white and Negro question is of long standing. A Negro should have all the rights and freedom as he has in our country. He is a human being and has feelings and a soul given him by God. However, God has placed between us a barrier of color. So therefore, we must accept this barrier and live, fight, and play separately with no malice or ill feeling between us, since we respect each other as free red-blooded men, but realize intermingling freely presents insurmountable or unsurmountable obstacles. I got the sense that that guy was trying to be nice about it, but at the same time, he was saying, no, he wants segregated units.
Yeah, and that really was the dominant sentiment, both in the actual data that they gathered and also in these handwritten answers as well. And it is jarring reading for sure. As many of your listeners will know, that the military was integrated just a couple of years after World War II in 1948, but all of these units were segregated at the time of World War II. Yeah, and I have one that's really interesting. It's from an African-American soldier, and he's writing in one of these open responses, and he says, why do I, as a Negro, wear the uniform and fight the Germans because of things that they have done? And the same things are being done in my own people here in this country. The Germans deny a minority group the privileges of working at profitable jobs and permit them only the most menial. In democratic America, the same thing exists, he wrote.
I was curious, what did the African-American, the black soldiers, what did they say? If you could paint a broad picture of what they had to say about segregation and serving with whites.
Well, they weren't asked about that, and they were initially not even surveyed until 1943, that the white units were part of this survey operation. I will say, though, once they were included in surveys from 1943 on, one of the main insights that came out of the social science of all of this was drawn from interviewing and these surveys of Black soldiers. This concept that is now since been made famous and is relative deprivation. So the researchers were really confused by this set of answers. They found that Blacks who were serving in northern bases were less happy, reported less content than those serving in southern bases. And they came up with this idea of relative deprivation. The African-American soldiers weren't comparing themselves to like some absolute standard. Instead, they were looking at the way that Southern Blacks outside the base were treated and found themselves like comparatively better off. And that was different in the North. So this idea of relative deprivation, it has gone on to have this long career. It's applied to lots of other things in the world of social science.
I was going to say, you sound like a social scientist when you talk about that. That sounds like another show for some time. So we only have a few minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. How do you think that this information can be used in the future?
Well, you know, one exciting aspect of this, I mean, I encourage your listeners to just go to this beautifully produced site, American Soldier WW2, the number 2.org, and just browse around. It's extraordinary. There's a great search engine. And, you know, I know that these will be used in schools, particularly at the high school level. There are already lesson plans that are developed. Colleges are going to be using these. I expect I'll use them in my methods classes. But I think the main benefit is for people who are interested in the country's history, its military history, to dive into the primary sources. They've read the books, maybe they've done some reenactments. Now they can go in and actually read the raw data, including these extraordinary handwritten statements from soldiers themselves.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we often do when we teach history or read about history is, you know, we talk about the battle plans, we talk about the strategies, that kind of thing. Well, this is actually hearing from the troops themselves, the experiences that they want. I could see a movie coming out of this, or maybe several movies, Professor. But, you know, and let me also say about that website you mentioned, it is a beautiful website. I mean, very well done. Not only can you, does it have a great search engine where it's broken down by entertainment, by rules, by race, you know, the different headings or subheadings. But once you get to it, there not only is a photograph of the handwritten, you know, survey results from 75, 80 years ago, but also you can read about it, as you said, those who transcribed it, so you can actually read. It doesn't matter that the handwriting may be good or bad, but I just think it's a great resource. Muhlenberg College Professor of Media and Communications, Jeff Pooley. Professor Pooley, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.